Kia ora, greetings and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Since the origin of humanity, power and control have been driving issues right up until the present, and in our everyday activities we today grapple with ways to live in freedom, being responsible citizens, being creative and building a harmonious, sustainable society. Yet it does not matter what place on earth that we are born, the challenge is to have a transparent, open society. We as a humanity are still having difficulty with trust, honesty, goodwill and community. Imagine, the Dolphin Society, a very peaceful social order that have no passports or identity cards, their whistles, squeaks and chirps being the only way they connect. Within their society, they are basically accepted for who they are at whatever level of the fullness of their being. If human beings were not on Earth today, the dolphin species as a society would be really flourishing in a state of joy and playfulness. Yet in Sweden, the Swedish freedom of information is a fantastic role model because it's so different from the English kind of public service view that we normally start with. In Sweden, most things, right down to the Prime Minister's personal mail and their daily work and their diaries, are automatically available. In New Zealand, that would be regarded as completely impractical and government would break down and people couldn't form policy. Yet in Sweden, they prove that by being open like that, governments work just as well as it does in other places, and all kinds of silly cover-ups and scandals and all sorts of misleadings of the public aren't just an issue because they cannot happen. So there it is, a Swedish model for us to follow, and I trust the world will follow it at our earliest convenience. With our planet now heaving under the weight of power and control games and crisis points in the environment to bringing peace, as well as dealing with a financial house of cards that is deconstructing before our eyes, the imperative is for a humanity to strive for a more open society where there is no need for practices that lack in truth, inclusiveness and goodwill. That time is now. On the phone from Wellington here in New Zealand, I have Nikki Hager, who is an investigative journalist. Nikki has been at the forefront of what has been happening behind the scenes here in New Zealand. His expose of the world's gigantic global surveillance system in the 1990s propelled him into the public consciousness. He has also been investigating the hidden actions of releasing GM corn in what is still a GE-free country, and he has also researched how hidden agendas within conservative, well-funded political parties have been secretly used against other political parties, as well as the infiltration of peaceful environmental groups protesting against both government and private indiscretions within the environmental movement. Kia ora and good morning, Nikki.
Good morning.
Nikki, as an investigative journalist, what took you into this particular arena, particularly here in New Zealand?
I think the first thing to say is that there isn't a career path into investigative journalism, even in large countries. There aren't jobs in the paper. It's not something that someone would hear from a careers advisor. And so for this kind of job, which I really love and I want to be doing, I think that the better way to see getting a job or what you do is not what jobs are out in the world, but following your own interests. That's how I got here. In fact, I'd been working in what you would call investigative journalism for about 10 years before I had the name attached to me and thought about myself in those terms. I'd come at it by following the career path that I believe in, which is people just doing, getting on with doing what they think is right and what they want to do. That was the route I got there by. And my natural aptitude was enjoying research, but I was trying to figure out the ways I could contribute best to my society. And that had taken me through working in politics and in various roles to do with politics. But I found that more and more that I felt that what was missing a lot in society was people who could independently probe subjects and find out what people weren't being told and get the other side of stories and quite often find out that the truth which gets repeated year after year in the news media and in public discussions isn't truth at all. It's just the truth of the powerful or the people who control the information. I enjoyed that role and I found that that was the way that I could really contribute. And so it just carried me into it. After I wrote my first book, I got invited to an overseas international investigative journalism conference to speak about it. This was one about intelligence. And being called an investigative journalist there was what kind of got me on the road of seeing myself in those terms. But before that, I was just doing what I thought needed to be done.
And then all of a sudden you came across, particularly in the mid-1990s, you came across the telecommunication industry, which you found that there was a listening system, a global listening system in place. How did you feel when you found this all out?
Well, when you look back on something you've done, it's all very linear, and it makes sense. And I could tell a story of how I was trying to uncover the way the American intelligence system works in the world, which I did contribute to doing, but it didn't really work that way. I'd been working as a researcher on defense issues. I'd been very interested in New Zealand's place in the American alliance. And there's just one small thread of that. Going back into the 1980s, I'd started looking at our most secret intelligence agency called the Government Communications Security Bureau, a forgettable and probably deliberately forgettable name of an organization, our largest intelligence agency in New Zealand. And while I was looking at it, I managed to make some breakthroughs, and that's often what leads a researcher on. It's important enough to work on, but many things that you try to work on don't actually work or don't go very far. But in this case, I was looking at this very secret agency, and I had some lucky breaks. I found things out. I found sources of information. I found particularly that I could calculate the names of all the staff and their positions from looking at public service records where they had been disguised and hidden. And I kind of decoded that and figured out who these most secret spies were and what their jobs were called and where they'd been posted overseas. And so a series of breakthroughs led me into studying it. But at that stage, I didn't imagine for a moment that I would be uncovering large things about how the American intelligence system worked. And that was just by following my nose and by the encouragement of my breakthroughs. I kept going on it. What actually happened is that I discovered what people had speculated, but which was not really known, which is that our intelligence services, even here in the south of the South Pacific, are a highly integrated small cousin or small partner of the United States intelligence agencies. That the equipment they use and the training manuals and the training courses and the target lists and their secret code words, in fact, the whole setup was a direct import. The manuals had American and British names on them. The priorities came from them. The whole system came from them. And what that meant was, which I'd never imagined when I went into it, is that when I started to get very deep sources within our intelligence services here, which I did, I interviewed eventually a large number of people who were working in these most secret facilities and organizations, that they weren't telling me about New Zealand systems particularly at all. They were telling me about the United States systems that they worked on. And by just historical accident, and combined with the fact that I'd ended up working on it, New Zealand being an open, quite not too militarized, not too paranoid kind of country, where I could actually meet and get to know and build up trust and talk to these secret intelligence agency people, that meant that New Zealand was the country where this news came out. These were systems that were worldwide systems. They were about how the United States spies on emails and electronic communications and phone calls all around the world. but New Zealand was the place where a lot of the news came out, just because I happened to be working on it, and something to do with the New Zealand culture. And so it would be very wrong to make it seem like I'd set out to do that, because it would have been such a presumptuous and unlikely thing to ever be able to imagine that I could reach. But research often works that way. That's the thrill of it, is that you have a general idea of something that's worth doing, and you dig away at it, and each step of the way, there's progress or not, there's a window opens, there's a foothold to get up to something that you couldn't previously reach, and gradually the subject opens up, and the possibilities and the worth of the information becomes clearer, and either draws you on or doesn't draw you on, which are, and in that case, drew me on spectacularly well to where I could write a book which has gone around the world and probably will be the most internationally well-known thing I ever do.
Yes, because it must have been very profound for you to find out that you were linked to a Canadian and an Australian and British and American intelligence as one global web. How did you sleep at night?
Comfortably. just to completely change the subject from the intelligence for a moment, when somebody does a job like this, you've also got a life, and it's really important to keep the thing separate, and you've got family, and I've got a child, and so I actually enjoy living a life where the external signs of my life are completely out of sync with what I'm doing, that there's fun, and there's games, and there's making up stories, and there's adventures, and there's the garden, and there's all that ordinary life going on. But when I walk to my desk, I'm doing the best work I can in some other realm, and a war, and corruption, or and something like that. But I like to keep the two worlds separate, and when I go to sleep, I'm not thinking about spies, or power, or governments. I'm probably thinking about family and things.
Well, that's lovely. It's really good to know that you can do that, and feel safe here in New Zealand in such a way as well.
One of the disadvantages of writing about spies, one of the things where I have felt some regrets about it, because that book led me on to some other projects to do with spies, and it will probably be something which I keep on doing as one of the strings in my bow, one of my areas of interest. One of the things I don't like about that is that I think that all discussion of these things encourages fear. That hopefully, I mean, the aim is to expose things to create change, that people have a realistic understanding of what's happening in their world, that they don't have unrealistic fears and they do have realistic concerns about what's real. But part of the job, which I don't like, or part of the results, is that you can have people who genuinely worry that their little protest group is being monitored, or people who have strange things in their lives or chaos in their lives, and they reinterpret that as being, you know, the CIA or the force of the darkness peeping in their windows. And so I actually find I spend a large amount of my time when I'm public speaking or meeting groups reassuring people that we do live in an incredibly safe country, that's New Zealand. And in fact, in the Western world, we're lucky enough to live in very safe countries. And we have, and people fear rather than reality is the biggest control on people's lives. And the best way we can deal with it is to not have that fear. To not feel restricted, to not feel constrained in what are mostly very free countries, where we have a vast, and you know, compared to the past, unbelievable range of opportunities available to us, safe opportunities. That it's a crime if we're spending our times worrying and fearing and feeling like we're in a repressive regime, because although there are things wrong, we live in a very safe one, and certainly that's how I feel. I live my own theory on that, and I don't feel that I am an object of surveillance, and if I happen to be, and I'm wrong about that, it's not actually affecting my life in a practical way, and I'll still do whatever I want to.
I agree with you. We have to be able to be present and just go straight into the future without holding on to too much that's gone behind us. Yes, Nikki, and of course then you've moved into the other realms of looking at genetic modification. And that one came through, and that too is sort of on the leading edge of what concerns people. How did you move into that field?
Well, that doesn't sound very similar, but let me explain the link. When I think about the books I've written and a lot of my work, the common thread is trying to help ordinary people understand politics. And not for theoretical reasons or entertainment, but because I think that, to me, it is fundamentally important to the future of the world and for all of us that people feel confident and hopeful and engaged in politics. That politics can be run, and I've written extensively on this, and I know the full disappointment and extent of it. The world will happily be run by lobby groups and industry lobby groups and the powerful, and they're happy if the rest of the populations, the so-called citizens, feel discouraged and excluded and don't bother trying. But to me, the hope of the world is when people feel personally hopeful and personally like they can make a difference, because it is a self-fulfilling belief that when people try, when someone like me tries or you try or any of us try, we actually discover we do have power. And so that's probably a uniting theme of my work, is looking at how power works. And in one realm, which I drifted into without a clear purpose, without a specific purpose, was this power politics and the way that intelligence affects that. But there are different realms. The book you're talking about, which had that, was in the context of New Zealand's genetic engineering policy and a particular incident that happened with genetically engineered crops. That was a much more subtle story about power. It was looking at the then Labour government, what would be regarded as a reasonably moderate so-called centre-left government. And I was looking at the subtle ways that a government like that stops being democratic. The way that expediency and secrecy and reliance on public relations rather than information and excluding the public from things just makes political management easier. Not democratic, but much easier for the politicians. And the kind of slippery slope, which means that things happen that the politicians wouldn't be proud of if the public knew about them. So that's a subtle level of politics. So it wasn't particularly about genetic engineering. Someone read it, they'd understand how the government spin doctors would do their work, what they actually do and how it has an effect on people, and how the government departments can be honourable or just part of bullshitting for the government, which they shouldn't do, but which there are forces and reasons why good people in all these different roles end up having negative effects on the way that democracy or society works. So that was the point of that book, and the context was at the time in New Zealand, an acute issue, which was whether we were going to allow genetically engineered crops into the country. But the larger context was how essentially pretty reasonable, progressive group of people who had formed the government ended up doing things that they themselves wouldn't have believed in before they went there, and acting in ways that they don't actually believe and would never stand up and just want to justify to their supporters and the public. But the forces on them and the results that has on the way politics works. So I'm very pleased with that little book, but it caused a huge storm of anger and opposition. So I'm not sure that many people even knew what it was about in the end.
My concern is that there's a lot of people who jump in and start judging without really having a look. And it's quite interesting hearing people's viewpoints. And there's a left-right slant. There appears to be more, I think, on the left, a softer look at you, whereas the right, for some unknown reason, usually they jump right down your throat when, in many cases, they are uninformed. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, the part of my work I least like is when an article or a book comes to publication, because I know that there's going to be such a disappointingly dumb response. The people who agree with the point, with the issues or the point of view, will say that it's a wonderful work of investigative journalism and a fine effort. And the people who don't like the results will say it's nutty and stupid, or they'll ignore it. And what I don't get, and what most people don't get in politics, which is a discouraging response, and a deliberately discouraging response, is that you don't get intelligent debate out of it. But I think it's important, when things like that happen, and this is what I'm talking about to do with the kind of writing and explaining that I try to do, it's not a matter of just accepting that as being the way things are, the world's discouraging and disappointing, it's actually understanding why it happens. Because these are tactics, these are plans, these are the results of real things. And so, for example, in our country, And most countries around the Western world and elsewhere are the same at the moment, is that when I produce a piece of work or when an event happens, the public mostly doesn't get it directly. Most people don't read books. That doesn't mean books aren't worthwhile, but they, information spreads in mysterious ways from voice to voice, from person to person, through other people picking up ideas. But if you want to understand what happens with some information or why issues bounce the way they do or get misunderstood the way they do, you have to look at the echo chamber. This is the public space where politics happens. And one of the things I find really striking is that with a particular piece of work that I do, I tally up who's attacked me, who's supported me, and who's given some kind of reasonable analysis of it. There's usually virtually no reasonable analysis. But if you're in our country, New Zealand, if you tally up the people who attack versus the people who don't, on whatever the subject is that I've written about, it's giving you kind of a snapshot of the political space, of the environment. And what it shows, most of the time, in my experience, when I've written something which I think is reasonable and informative and balanced, is that about 80 to 90% of the commentators, the people who are asked to comment on the radio and the TV, the people who write the regular columns where they interpret the news for the public, the echo chamber which makes things seem right and wrong and reasonable or loony or whatever it is, 80 or 90% of those people are pretty hard right. Quite a lot of them, to be frank, are right-wing bigots who reflect a really dumb part of the political discussion in the country. But if they're the majority of the voices who are the first line of amplification and acceptance or rejection or commentary on ideas that come out, that does have an effect on the political environment. And when you're in the position of writing like I do, and of having issues or books or whatever it is coming out that you've done, you become quite aware of the inherent bias of the environment that you're going into. And to me, I'm saying this because I think that ordinary people should understand why things seem the way they do, why an issue which in your heart seems like a reasonable one is treated the way it is, why some people get smeared and other people get held up as being champions. The answer, what an ordinary person should do is to understand the environment rather than just to be puzzled about the results that come out of the environment.
Very interesting. Yes, Nikki. I'm speaking with Nikki Hager, an investigative journalist in Wellington. And, of course, the echo chamber goes over into your more recent of books, The Hollow Men. And so what you're really saying, Nikki, is that there's a lack of depth within a lot of beings. And, of course, The Hollow Men is not only a metaphor for this, but also the fact is that you found in the book Hollow Men that there were people who were manipulating the situation and there was no real character. They didn't have any what you call virtues that you would like to instill in your children. Can you mention a little bit about this?
Yeah, I'll talk about the book The Hollow Men. Even for a New Zealand audience, I think lots of people won't even understand what the book was about. And I was very proud of this book, and it lives up very well to that thing I was talking about of trying to let people understand the politics they live in so that they're not discouraged, they're informed by what they see, by what they're seeing around them. But an ordinary person, what would they have seen when my book came out? This is a book that came out 2 years ago called The Hollow Men. It's an in-depth 3-year story of our main Conservative Party in New Zealand, the National Party. What most people got about the book was not the contents. They got stuff from what I was saying, that echo chamber, from what was more than 90% of the commentators attacked it. The National Party carefully and calculatedly worked out its public relations lines for trying to spin the book. And so an ordinary New Zealander would think that was the book which was something to do with the National Party leader Don Brash's emails. And the National Party said they were stolen emails and they wouldn't know terribly much else about it or they wouldn't remember terribly much else because that was what got the most mileage. And And anyone who believes that would be missing out on a real treasure, because I'd like to spend a moment just telling people what's in the book if they didn't know. Because for someone interested in politics, this really shouldn't be missed. What happened was this was a deliberate and very focused piece of research on my part. The then leader of the National Party, Don Brash, had given a powerful and very important speech about race. And it was actually an appallingly cynical, or it looked to me and many people like an appallingly cynical exploitation of race for the sake of increasing his percentage of the popularity stakes just after he'd become the leader of that party a few years ago. And I set out quite deliberately in this case, not just generally looking around and having a breakthrough, but quite specifically searching for some way to get behind that story and be able to say what had really been going on when he gave that powerful and very damagingly influential speech about race in New Zealand. It took me a few years, but this is a side of investigative work which I just love, because persistence does work. And I say this because I hope people are listening who have things that they care about and they would like to do this about, because persistence and strategically searching and having a clear focus or problem that you're trying to crack really does work, because it's happened over and over again in my work. So I wanted to get inside this party, which was naturally probably hostile towards me from other books and things I'd written. And by the end of about 2 years' hard work, I found sources there who were prepared to provide me with not just inside gossip, but this massive collection of inside papers, emails, strategy documents, itineraries, you name it, the whole work, internal workings of a political party, which was aiming to become government and has since become government in New Zealand as a major party. What these papers were, they were the communications between the most inner group of that party, the leader, the chief strategists, the spin doctors, the media spin doctors, the speech writers, the external strategists like their Australian election strategists, the little in-group who do the main politics of a political party of a country these days, who devise the tricky ads, who devise the messages, who figure out the strategies to get them out of crises and problems. And what I had was 3 years of their discussions with each other about how to lie and when to lie and what to cover up and who their secret donors were and how they had to placate them and the whole works of how a party works. And so it's really marvelous, but great responsibility on myself to try to make it into a good book. The reason I say I feel proud of it is that I think I did succeed in that. Anyone in New Zealand or elsewhere who'd like a rivetingly real in their own voice case study of how modern political manipulation and management and trickery works, it's all there in their own words, including, and I was really proud about this personally, I felt personal achievement about this, was getting to the bottom of that story about what had been going on with that racist speech, which had been so influential, which had lifted a flagging, a not very successful National Party up 7 percentage points in the polls in a month to being in the lead and looking like it would win the election. And the story is there for all to see. The cynical discussions, the discussion about how they needed to exploit an issue, the careful concoction of a speech with the right ingredients of prejudice in it, to appeal to particular sectors. It's really good. This is where this work, the satisfaction of my work comes, is knowing that that history will hopefully now be told correctly. And that's not seen as an achievement or a clever act or a worthwhile thing in our history, but it's the dirty thing that was, which is now discredited and swept aside.
Nicky, can you tell our listeners a little bit, how is power working here in this country? In the political arena, I guess that's where we need to start. But it's affiliated to the corporate arena as well. And then there are overseas interests who have got banking interests. Can you enlighten us?
Happy to talk about that subject, because that's the subject that I spent all my days wading through and saving papers about and having interviews with people. I'd like to pose a simple view of how the world works. And of course, things are never simple, but I'd like to propose an overview. But first of all, to contrast it with what we're given, the kind of popular, optimistic, naive, I would say childish view of politics is that there are political parties and there are politicians, and political parties put their policies in front of people, and politicians are variously principled or ambitious people who are trying to pursue their own careers. And it's a kind of a spectator sport where we get a vote every once in a while, but we watch these people pursuing their ends and we vote for them according to what they believe in. That's kind of what you might call the superficial newspaper view of politics. My view of politics is, which is, I'm saying, is also going to be a simple one, but which I think is way closer to the truth, is that you look at where the power resides in your society. And it's quite easy and realistic to paint a picture of how most power resides far away from the citizens and far away from Parliament, and that most members of Parliament are really just going for the ride and not having very much influence at all, which I do believe, and I think gradually they realise themselves in many cases. And who has the power? You have to work through issue by issue. You look at housing and you say, why doesn't New Zealand have a capital gains tax? Why do we have this incredibly deregulated system? Why do we have the kind of laws we have? And then you look at a number of vigorous, well-funded industry lobby groups that push that point of view. Why are other areas of society, like the finance sector, deregulated greatly to the advantage of the banks or the finance companies and to the disadvantage of ordinary people? And again, you'll find that there's long-term strategies of industry lobby groups, industry spokespeople, industry-funded lawyers who sue and challenge the government when they're trying to change something they don't like, long-term media strategies that make their worldview look like the right one, and sponsorship of the commentators and spokespeople and experts and reports and the news, which makes things look the way they want the world to look and to support the policies they believe in. And you can paint a depressing and quite convincing picture that on most issues, most of the time, they never even come to the stage of being issues. They're determined and decided by the self-interested, organized, well-resourced efforts of powerful and well-resourced lobbies. The alcohol laws, mostly decided by the alcohol industry. The transport laws, mostly decided by the transport lobbies, and so on. And there's no denying that. That's the world we live in. And anyone who thought that that was a unrealistic or conspiracy theory kind of view is actually just hasn't looked through the phone book and seen these organizations and what they're lobbying for and understanding what they do. And that would be a bleak and disappointing picture of the world, and it would be a pretty sufficient explanation for the short-termism, the way that policies don't seem to reflect things that an ordinary person would think matter about the future, because they seem to be very focused on the immediate profits and the immediate priorities of mindlessly self-serving commercial entities, which aren't interested in what things look like 50 years later, or necessarily their impact on the public, or even their impact on New Zealand in many cases, because they're foreign-owned. So that's the bleak picture, but that's only half the picture, luckily, and I'm actually very optimistic about politics. I am realistic about the environment we live in, which is that we're not all equal, that there's not equal power, that there are powerful influences. But my optimism comes from the fact that that picture is only true if other people aren't active, if other people are demoralized, if other people unconsciously sense their powerlessness and never try. But my other experience, personal and watching the world, is that when groups of people get organized, when the public is motivated, when the public is educated, in other words, is informed with what is going on and doesn't just get one side of spin from the vested interests, but actually hears other points of view, then first of all, ordinary old people are a very reliable source of common sense and good policy. Not in short-term ways, because the public can be whipped up into fear and hostility and hatred towards groups of society, but in a long-term way. In other words, not what do you think about criminals straight after there's been lots of publicity about a gory murder, but in a longer-term way on most issues, people are very sensible. And when people get organized, that is why we don't have a barren, soulless society, because we not only live amongst the results of all those commercial forces, we live in a society which has in many ways and constantly and in interestingly developing ways been developed by the collective action and concerns and thought of non-commercial things, of citizens, of democracy. And that's where I put my hope, because I see even at times when people might be discouraged and feel it's not like this, I think that all the time there is an immense amount of evidence and example and hope coming from the people who are trying to make a difference in different ways in society. And so how do I analyse society? It's a struggle between essentially selfish and kind of small brain dinosaurish short-term production or money-making versus what is a really vibrant, intelligent citizenry who are, not everybody all the time, but their efforts on issues of disability or civil rights within sectors of society, there are people working on that really hard, invisible, often invisible to everyone else, but making the difference in those areas. Or if it's on this area of conservation, we might have powerful interests winning in Parliament, but all over the country there are people who are fixing up swamps and regenerating the forest and the hills behind their houses and getting rid of the pests. What I would argue is that this struggle goes on all the time between the commercial short-term interests and the citizenry. How much good there is in the world or how depressing the world looks is a function of how powerful those commercial forces are at the time compared to how powerful and well-organized the citizens are feeling. In bad times, when ordinary people feel discouraged and don't bother to participate, and society ebbs and flows in that way, in bad times are also when the commercial forces are given too much power, which is the period that New Zealand has just recently lived through, which was the free market years, which was putting much more power into the hands of commercial actors. But overall, history goes on, and sometimes some of them are more dominant, sometimes other ones are more dominant, but the fact is that even at the grimmest of times, or the least hopeful of times, there are hundreds and thousands of people doing really good things and making the country a better place. At the same time as New Zealand went through an awful period of a war, or the privatizations we had in the 80s and 90s, which restructured the power in New Zealand to a huge extent, there are other people who are making fantastic educational or social progress on other things. And one, the bad things can happen at the same time as the good things. And if you only notice the bad ones, then someone's not realizing how much progress we're making. And the reason why I'm saying this, of course, to myself and to others, is that if we only see the bad stuff and we're discouraged by it, then it's more of the bad stuff and less of the people who are trying to make a difference. That hope, that most important commodity of all, hope, is the thing that makes more people bother and which lets more people do the things where they discover their power and have more social progress and more progressive ideas and more socially caring, environmentally caring activities going on. And so that's the struggle which I see in society the whole time. That to me is a simple and a hugely simplified but pretty robust, helpful way of viewing what goes on so that we understand why things turn out the way they are without being overwhelmed and discouraged about it, and we understand what we can do about it by having a realistic and encouraging sense of what can be achieved by anybody who tries to make a difference.
I'm speaking with Nikki Hager, an investigative journalist from Wellington. And Nikki, yes, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of volunteers working all the time through all the tiers of society, a lot of cooperation, and of course, they have Christmas parties that pulls them all together again, and there's just this incredible participation of people, isn't there?
There is, and we should all be very conscious, because we've got used to thinking that you see the world through the news media. There's a difference between what's conspicuous and what's reality. The most conspicuous voices in New Zealand, as I said, are often the redneck, bigoted right-wing voices. But that doesn't mean those are the main beliefs in New Zealand. In fact, the public remains remarkably progressive and open-minded compared to what you hear in the media. And also, in terms of conspicuousness, we are much more likely to hear about the activities of a company than we'll ever hear about little groups or valiant researchers and trusts and social organizations and Mirai committees and things who are doing wonderful things. But the fact that we don't hear about it doesn't mean it's going on. And if people aren't aware of it, they just have to step out the door and choose the issue they care about or start to talk to other people, and that depressing sense of powerlessness evaporates because you meet all these people who are doing good things.
I agree. I know there's lots of gardens going up, community gardens, particularly in the South Auckland Mungere area, and it's drawing people out. They feel that they belong to something and they've got a stake in the future. And so can I ask, how can we empower people more? You write a book and then you get a lot of criticism. Do you find that you need to put questions in to ask your critics to sort of self-reflect on, to see if you can make them bite deeper into the book to see if they can get some nourishment out of it?
I should say, I think I probably gave the wrong impression with what I was saying about the book. I get criticism, and I know it for what it is. It's tactical. It's not an engagement. It's a deliberate disengagement. It is saying the words and making the posturings to try to stop other people reading something which they don't want to be read. But actually, I've had 4 books so far, and all of them have been bestsellers, and they've been widely read. And I've found a huge interest and appetite. If no one was interested, that would be a really disappointing experience, but that's not my experience. My experience is that people do want this, that at the same time as news media are claiming that the public doesn't want to read and that they're dumb, that I find I get more and more interest in what I do. So I wouldn't like to give the impression that I think that people, that I mainly just deal with criticism. In fact, I mainly receive personal thanks and congratulations for doing the kind of work I do, and I know that there's a thirst for it out there. Again, it's important to distinguish between the public expressions and what's really going on inside society. But what was the other thing you asked me?
It was how we can empower the people to really take the next step to sort of... Well, the question is there a lot of honesty in New Zealand and in government and in business? Because as an investigative journalist, you will see lots of distortions. And Time magazine mentioned that New Zealand was one of the top countries when it came to honesty in business, and yet look underneath the surface and there's all sorts of distortions going on.
Well, that's a very big question. I think that New Zealand is in some respects a wonderfully uncorrupt and honest and reasonably open kind of country. But I also think that it's not a very democratic country at all, that we're complacent about democracy, we're complacent about who has power and how they exercise it, which is not about honesty, it's actually about raw power and how your society works. And that was about that picture I gave there. And although my work involves digging into the things that are wrong and digging into the times where people don't tell the truth, I believe the reason to do that is not to say the world is a terrible place, but to talk about and emphasize the values that we do want the society to be run by. And that's how I think most people take it. They don't take it as a message about how everything's hopeless and awful. I think when people read about these things, it energizes them about what they believe in and how they want the society to be shaped, and then it's a constructive process. What can ordinary people do? What can somebody do who wants to make a difference? I think everybody is looking at that. And my list would be, first and most importantly, is that people don't adopt that manner that's called cynicism, kind of called don't like politics cynicism, because I believe that that is a sign of discouragement and alienation from politics, dressed up as cynicism, that people just feel powerlessness and hopeless. And I would urge people to not fall into that trap, because it suits the powerful and industry lobby groups and the whatever it is, very well for other people not to bother. It's the most convenient, efficient way to run a country is to have ordinary people discouraged and excluded. That is the default setting for a modern, decadent Western democracy. but it's not how things have to be. And I would urge anybody who is feeling like that to look at all the role models there are of people who are making a difference. And we can all do this. We can all think, oh, it's all, where are all the bright people? Where are all the people who care? Why do I just see that these hectoring voices on TalkBack or whatever? But actually, you just have to open your eyes and cross the street and talk to people and ask people what they're doing when they seem to be digging something by the side of that stream down the road from where you live, or poke your nose into people who are running a group or organizing a sausage sizzle outside the supermarket or wherever it is. And it doesn't take very long before you find people everywhere who are trying to make a difference at different levels. And the people who care about politics, there are groups to get engaged in, finding people who you like and want to share your life with, or share some of your life with, and try to make a difference. We're a country full of people, luckily, who believe in making a difference, and lots of them are achieving it. So the main thing is for people to get out and find people who inspire them and who they want to do it with. And there's endless role models and opportunities and things that need to be done in that way. And when people do that, my experience is that they discover that they've got power, and they discover that the part of them which is a political animal which wants to express itself can express itself, and it can be a hugely satisfying experience. That when you leave behind that sense of powerlessness and discouragement and discover who you are.
I was born in the farming sector in the Waikato, and all the farmers around us were so easygoing. They were really good people. Their families were full and vibrant. And I feel that we've gone from something to a time now where speed and expediency has really got in the way of relationships. And my question is, how do you see New Zealand in the future? How it comes together? How can we be a gregarious nation of goodwill and being seen in the outer world as a country that's at peace with itself, multicultural and fair play and justice? I see so many possibilities.
I see possibilities, and I'm going to, in a way, say the same thing I've already said. Left to itself, with people not participating, with people being spectators to politics rather than participants, with people just playing the game as it's put in front of them of being busy shoppers rather than citizens, then the future is pretty bleak. We're going to be thoughtless and irresponsible with the environment. We're going to be thoughtless about our neighbours. We're going to be clones of the United States in our foreign policy, because that's the long-term, big, powerful force that operates on our political system. Left to itself, the outcome is not pretty, and it's discouraging, but that's not actually what's going on. I think that what you see is all sorts of people who want things to be different. I think that New Zealand's been through a dark period, which was that selfish, you know, look after number one free market period. And those are actually, even though we've got a National Act government right now, they are operating in an environment where their ideas are discredited. That's not what most people believe in anymore. They don't believe in that. Privatisation is a dirty word. Deregulation, when people come up face to face with it, doesn't look like such a good idea either nowadays. Where I see the optimistic future is people being, all sorts of people being focused on what matters in their communities and their environment, and getting on and doing stuff. And as I say, the struggle will go on. The struggle will go on between the short-term commercial forces and the long-term humane, socially concerned, goodwill, happy, musical, outgoing forces. And on that basis, I think that we've got an optimistic future because most people, most ordinary people, want the same kind of things as you or I. And that's what matters, is that they keep wanting that and that they're shaping New Zealand by it.
And as a father, how do you want your daughter to express her life? Same virtues, of course, what you encourage, but is there anything else? Because it's got another 100 years to nearly to look forward to.
I don't know. She's got to live her own life, actually. I feel about her the way I feel about the rest of society, really. That I just want her to be open-minded and understand what's going on so that the discouraging things don't crush her, or the disappointing things don't crush her, and that she can also see all the good things, and that those can encourage her. And And the combination of those, I think, is all we can hope for in the future, because good will come out of that.
And finally, Nikki, where do you feel your journalism is going to take you? You just take it day by day, and what comes through, an email or a conversation, may just take you into whatever realm needs looking at.
No, it's not like that at all. Actually, sometimes it is. Sometimes the phone rings, and it's kind of like, you know, the call arrives at the fire station. But mostly, the kind of work I do is very long term. I can't say I want to find out what's happening inside the National Party and produce something for next Sunday. I couldn't do that. I don't have the skills. I don't know how, and it doesn't seem to work that way. So what I do is I have a whole series of subjects which I think it would make a difference to society. It would be worthwhile. People would value me being able to dig into, or someone would be able to dig into. And I'm working away on them at once. I've got many subjects which you wouldn't even imagine that I'm already working on, which may work one day or may not, on all range of subjects. And I have a breakthrough, or it seems like the right time, and they come out of my files, and I pull them together into a book or an article. So, in fact, I've got a dozen or more things that are on the conveyor belts at the moment, and I hope maybe I'll have another book in the next year or two on something which is big, or there'll be articles which I'm ready to produce when it seems like the right time or the right trigger. And I'll just keep being guided by what feels important.
Very good, Nikki. Well, look, I want to say thank you very much for coming and sharing with New Zealanders, and to let them know that you've got your books there, that if they wish to read and get a deeper understanding of what you are wanting to say. But I feel we've learnt a lot from you today, just speaking as two human beings.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk to you.
Bye-bye. This Green Planet radio program has been broadcasting from Auckland Sky Tower for 4 years now, and this has been a very stimulating and information-rich time for me as a presenter, and I trust for you as listeners. It is now also streamed from the web on www.planetaudio.org.nz or www.holisticliving.co.nz. This takes us to a global audience which I trust inspires individuals, families and communities wherever they may be on our marvellous planet to consciously work in peace to a sustainable and a better world of tomorrow. And how things have changed, especially over last year. We have come to a realisation that the monetary ways of man has been eaten away by the tapeworm economy, which lacking any virtue has been built as a house of cards. This house is now having its foundations eroded away from underneath it, and we need to be very astute in reading behind the headlines and accessing our information from alternative news sources. We need to be proactive in researching both the challenges and the solutions to our current dilemma. And though the economic essentials are currently overriding the dogged headway we have made in environmental awareness over the last few years, it is crucial that we bring balance to both these two imperatives as we move towards sustainability. The urgency can only be understood from the knowledge of deep ecology that the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat comes from the environment. Its source springs from a healthy living planet, and it is vital that we connect the dots by thinking things through to make the connection. Mysteriously enough, it is worth noting that the words ecology and economy share the same root from the ancient Greek word ekos, which translates to meaning house or habitat. Economy refers to how to manage our house, and ecology, how to know or understand it. These are two sides of the same coin, and one day soon, I trust, we'll have politicians and business people realize this and take appropriate and urgent action to bring about a new understanding of our relationship to this living planet that loans us bodies in which to live. Last year, I said that we are at the juncture of the Earth's evolution where solutions are currently required to find ways to avert the consequences of not being truly conscious of our interrelationship with ecological concerns and all biota. And especially that we be mindful of the billions of children that across the face of our planet are in need of love and leadership as they look forward to their yet unrealized future. So what has quickly emerged in the last year across New Zealand has been the term transition towns. Transition towns now number 43 across the country and are gathering momentum. very much like the nuclear-free zones that sprang up across New Zealand back in the mid-1980s to counter the lunacy of the nuclear arms race that was escalating at that time. www.transitiontowns.org.nz is an initiative for our times, where community at grassroots levels is springing forth a leaderless movement to respond to the twin challenges of climate change and peak oil, but can now be seen as an instrument to react to the global economic fallout that is regrettably gathering impetus, as well as act as a backup civil response in the case of earthquake or tsunami if such unfortunate occurrences happen. These transition towns are popping up in towns, suburbs, islands, communities and regions, and the aim is to relocalize communities, making them vibrant, resilient and truly sustainable. And what pulls them together are permaculture, organic gardens for producing food, and living economies where localized currencies such as green dollars and time banking can assist the community to remain cohesive and peaceful during times of transition and hardship. Google Transition Towns and check for yourself. So I encourage you to research and see the idea of a transition town in your locality. It's such a positive affirmation for what conscious people can achieve and may be very necessary in times ahead. And let us think and discuss innovative ways to promote solutions for our individual and collective future with both our friends and neighbours, where we move forward as a nation to become our planet's leader in sustainability. At present, I'm working with www.greenplanetfm.com to give you more information about the people interviewed and a blog that offers insights that are intuited. With direct streaming and 3 iPod downloads, I encourage you to access planetaudio.org.nz or holisticliving.co.nz. Next year is coming a feast of information that I trust will proclaim 2009, the year when planet Earth finally comes of age, where citizens come together to realize that we are one family within the biosphere and that we deliver solutions by activating them into love and action. Let us continuously realize the sacredness of life and be thankful to be alive at this time, especially to realize that we human beings have this latent virtue that we are energy bundles of exponential potential. If your company or organization harmonized with the ideal of this Green Planet program and wanted to support it with sponsorship, please have your advertising department contact me at timlynchnz@yahoo.co.nz. That is timlynchnz@yahoo.co.nz. I will appreciate your contact. This is Tim Lynch, in the spirit of goodwill, wishing you a Pāhūtakawa Christmas and a Happy New Year and a special time of grace where past difficulties and animosities are forgiven as we work towards a planet of unity, peace and humanity. Bye-bye and haere rā.
Radio, on air and online. Complete the form on Planet